Welcome to the second season of Boss Level. It's good to be back. All the recording for the upcoming Embridge album is now done, and it'll be mixed and mastered in a month or so. I'll let you know when it's out. The second season of this podcast starts now. A new episode will be published every 2 weeks until the end of June. The lineup of guests is going to be legendary. The aim is to have episodes that are thought-provoking, entertaining, interesting, and useful. The first guest for the second season of Boss Level is Linda Liukas. She's changing the world by helping kids learn technology. Her TEDx talk is just about to reach 1 million views. We discuss learning, education, writing, and technology. A word of warning, though, her enthusiasm is pretty infectious. So, enjoy.
I'm multiple things. I'm a children's book author, first of all. I'm an illustrator. I'm a mediocre programmer. I'm a storyteller. I'm a public speaker. And I think that's kind of been the professional persona I've had. It's that computers are binary. They can be one thing or the other, but people contain multitudes, if I'm allowed to flirt with Walt Whitman a little bit. And that's what I've tried to become, someone who is multiple things at the same time. Actually, all of these identities were like in parentheses for a long time. I felt that, oh, I can't really tell or call myself a children's book author because I've never really published before. That's one of the tricks you do when you want to become something. You start
calling yourself.
Exactly. Very deliberately calling yourself. I'm a children's book author. And eventually people will either call you a bluff or then you will actually become the thing you want to be. Yeah. But anyways, so the book project is called Hello Ruby. It's the world's most whimsical way to learn about programming and computers and technology. And yeah, I'm the author and illustrator of that book.
Yeah. Okay. And to be able to write that book, you probably need to know at least a little about programming.
A little bit, yes. As much as a six-year-old should.
Yeah. Okay. And have you ever actually programmed for a living?
No, not properly. Mm. But I've worked with a product team where I worked in the sort of the QA / engineering / communication. So I was in like interaction with the team quite a bit. And now, now I've been working on the HelloRuby.com page. So it's a Rails application, and I'm trying to figure out how to sort different play exercises and do that stuff. So,
and then again, I mean, you do have history in the field of programming through Rails Girls,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
So what was that?
So Rails Girls was really like scratching our own itch. I was studying in Stanford University at the time, and mm-hmm. when you're in Stanford, it's just full of people who are really excited about technology, and you can sort of get excited about programming when you're spending time there. And then I came back to Helsinki, and everyone, and this was 2009, I think, and everyone was excited about social media in my circles, and I felt that that's not what I'm excited about. I'm excited about the whole ethos of building things and making something out of nothing and so forth and so forth. And then me and Kari, we decided to run a workshop for some of our mutual friends. And it was, I think it was done in 2 weeks or something. And Vesa Vanska from Kisko Labs did the first curriculum. And I remember we made tomato soup for everyone. It was very sort of low-key and and easygoing. And then the internet happened. So people started to tweet about the event. And the whole idea was really to sort of bring out the more magical side of programming, the more crafty side of things. And instead of going through a lot of theory, give the young women the experience of what it does it mean and feel like to build a website or a web application in one day. And the app that they build there is like a Pinterest type of an application. It's one Rails scaffold. It's just like a listing application for ideas or pictures or so forth. But within that simple framework, you can do all sorts of fun things like, say, make an application for the best places to have ramen in Berlin or my prettiest red high heels collection and so forth and so forth. So anyways, fun, exciting, talking about the culture of technology, because for me, it was always important to understand the people and the structures of the organization or the culture that I was entering. So we would talk a lot about who is David Heinemeier Hansen, or okay. why do people say that like Mats is nice and thus we are nice, who is Yukihiro Matsumoto and so forth. So very sort of fun, whimsical, low-key thing. And yeah, the internet happened and people started to tweet about it. And I think today Rails Girls has been in 260 cities around the world or a little crazy. Bit over that. It's absolutely crazy. Never intended that to happen.
Did you visit all those cities?
No. I don't think I've organized a Rails Girls event in 2 or 3 years. So it's very much grassroots driven and just tells that people are really, really, really willing to change stuff if you allow them. If you give them a framework to work with, they will do amazing things.
And is it still going strong?
Yeah. There's going to be a health event in Helsinki in early April. And every single day there's like new events coming up. Well, every single week at least. And just really like the most craziest of places, like, I don't know, Jordania, Amman in Australia, in Belarus, in Belo Horizonte, in Middle East. So really spreading.
Wow. And on top of this, you also mentioned that you're a speaker. So what kind of topics do you speak about?
I think I'm an inspirational speaker. That's the most common. I talk about technology. I talk about learning. I talk about the future. But I think I talk mostly to sort of businessmen and members of the board and really serious people. But I talk in a way about their world that probably is like inspiring and enlightening and makes them feel good.
Yeah. I remember like one of your talks, I mean, I remember you talking about programming as a way to express yourself. And I think that's a really interesting view on it. I mean, when I heard you say it, I was like, yeah, of course that's what it is. But I'd never kind of thought of it that way. But I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, there's some really big ideas in computing and CS and programming that, especially coming as an outsider to this field, it's maybe easier for me to vocalize and sort of reflect back to the layman or the people who have absolutely nothing to do with programming. Sometimes it feels like when I talk with programmers, you understand the world so perfectly already that the obvious things are not obvious for you anymore. So.
And actually going back to the children's book, so how did Hello Ruby become about?
For a lot of pain and a lot of suffering and a lot of tears. I know you said that this is not like a good feelings podcast, but so Hello Ruby was, for the longest of time, it was just an idea for me, and I figured that like there ought to be a book in the world that talks about the world of software that I saw as a colorful and exciting place. And I was 23 or 24 when I was teaching myself Ruby programming. And every time I would run into something that I wouldn't understand, like what is object-oriented programming or what is garbage collection? Like the technology world is so full of acronyms and words that are hard to understand and sometimes like inconvenient to ask, what does this mean? So I would try to explain them to myself in a way that a six-year-old little girl would explain it. And because I was teaching myself Ruby at the time, of course the little girl would be called Ruby. And because I come from Scandinavia or Finland, it would be a red-haired little girl like Pippi Longstockings and Little Moo. And then something weird happened in my brain where some people, they see numbers as colors. And I started to see the world of technology as stories. And all of a sudden, it totally makes sense that like say if you're talking about Apple, the company, it would be this beautiful snow leopard who doesn't want to play with the other kids and is a little bit snobbish, but also loves beautifully designed things. And and Androids would be these little robots that are really, really friendly but super messy and grow way too fast. And penguins would be, or like Linux would be, this penguin character that would be really, really book smart but somewhat hard to understand, but ruthlessly efficient and so forth. So it was really a story to myself in the beginning, and my mom would ask like, oh, why are you making some sort of a Soviet propaganda like 70s book? But the idea bubbled for the longest of times. I think the first time I talked about the project was in 2009. So it was 4 or 5 years in the making. And when I moved back from New York to Helsinki, I had a lot of time in my hands, and I had all like, again, I had started to talk about myself as a children's book maker. So I needed to do something with the project, and then I did the best and the worst thing in my life. I ran a Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Kickstarter campaign, that gathered up a lot of money in a fairly short
and
amount of time.
A lot of pressure.
I'm sure.
So
yeah.
I was asking for $10,000, which was sort of the bare minimum that I figured that, okay, if I'm going to self-publish a book, that's what's going to keep me afloat for the 3 months that I need to make this book happen. And during the first 24 hours, the book raised $100,000, and I panicked, and I remember crying and then like being almost under the bed and being like, oh my goodness, now I actually need to make this book happen. So and it ended up gathering $380,000 worth of pre-orders. My guess though is that a lot of that money came from the Rails Girls community, like the people who had seen me work very sort of for the community for a long time and trusted me with their money. Yeah, my life totally changed in 24 hours.
Yeah, that's crazy. I can just imagine how it must feel if you're going for 10,000 and you're like within 24 hours you're at 100. I mean, that's,
And that's just where this journey started from. Yeah. It's been a really weird 2 years of ups and downs and really like the community around Kickstarter was amazing. But then it's also been one of the personally most sort of, well, if not depressing, at least like anxious times that I've gone through in my life, because of course the project was delayed and of course there were like problems with the like publisher and manufacturing and shipping and everything, and everything was like a month late, and you absolutely do not remember the good words people say to you, the worst words where they are like, oh, it's going to be okay and you're doing good and just take the time you need. You remember the really shitty comments and feel bad about yourself.
I guess that comes with anything that you do that's fairly public. I mean, there's going to be a lot of talk on both sides. Okay, but where's the project now? I mean,
so the book is ready and I'm working on book two, which is going to come out next fall. Everyone keeps on asking me, is it like frustrating or scary or is there a lot of pressure in making the book two? Nope. It's like easy peasy this time around. I think making a book in some ways it's hard because the second book doesn't know you made the first book. So there's always the part that is frustrating and scary, but at the same time it's like I know that it's part of the process now, so it's much easier. Then we're working on a mobile app, which is fun and exciting, and then a summer school project.
Wow. I actually want to talk a little more about the writing process, because you might have heard that Henkka Hyppönen was on the podcast, and he had this style that I think he mentioned that he learned it from Stephen King, where he sets a target for himself for like what he wants to write within that day. Mm-hmm. And then when he's done with that amount of words, then he's just like, okay, I'm done for the day, and so on. And he felt that that's a really good approach, because it's kind of that once you're done, then you can say that I'm done for the day and you won't feel guilty for the rest of the day when you're like with your kids or whatever and doing things that are not related to your book.
Well, so, I feel guilty like 24 hours of the day. So maybe making picture books is a little bit different because there's much less words and it's much more about like iterating the text and the pictures and the relationship between the text and the pictures and what do you choose to tell and what are you showing and so forth. But I do think that the basic principle really applies, that you need to be really rigorous about saying no to like outside projects when you are in the in the midst of actually writing the book and blocking time. And now that I know kind of how much does it take time to, for instance, illustrate a book, it's much easier to say that, okay, like this is the week that I'm not going to do anything else than book stuff.
So actually, and also one thing that Henkka mentioned was that he, like when he starts a new project, he always needs at least 2 weeks like to just focus like only on that.
Makes for me the process again a little bit different, because I feel like I'm like a sponge for 2 or 3 months. I just get ideas and so forth, but it's so hard and frustrating to jump from that to the actual writing of the book, because browsing through Pinterest or like reading articles about programming education, that's not writing a book. Writing a book is the actual act of sitting down and making the book happen. And maybe that's been the hardest part for me, is to move from the sort of the planning stage to the execution and production stage of making a book.
So thinking back to, like, okay, you mentioned that there was a lot of difficulties in getting the first book out and a lot of delays and so on. What are the things that you're kind of doing differently now with the new book?
So I'm trying to involve the team more, and the team means in this case the editors and sort of the picture art directors and so forth. And to some extent, making a book is a very lonely process because you need to keep everything in your head and sort of be the mastermind. But it's so funny because when I code, I'm really open to showing people like code that is not ready. And when I write texts, I'm pretty like open and okay to sharing things that are not finished with other people. But with a book, like it feels so scary to show things that are not finished to people, to get feedback, because you kind of feel that they are judging your personality and your self-worth with their comments. So that's what I'm definitely trying to do differently, share more early and more often. And then, it's probably about the mindset that it's normal and okay to feel frustrated, and that's part of the process.
Yeah.
Embracing that.
Yeah. I think a lot of things, when you know that this is, like, I mean, when you kind of set your mind to the fact that this is going to be hard and it's going to be depressing at times and it's going to be really bad at times, it's kind of easier to deal with it when it comes
around.
Maybe
for Finnish people, at least.
Actually just reminded me of this thing that an American told me, that, like, in Finland, when you, like, if you're at a bus stop and if you start talking to, of course you never start talking to anyone, but if you would, then you'd start talking about how bad the weather is and like how bad things are at work or something like that, whereas the American way would be to always, like, start talking about the good stuff. And that's a big difference. You'd start talking about how good the weather is and how, like, the summer is coming and so on.
But yeah, I think I did that when I started to talk about myself as a children's book author, but yeah, then everything else was kind of we'll see. One thing I feel a lot of the times is the sort of value of repetition and the value of just persevering, and that's what we Finns are really good at. And for instance, when learning to draw, I think one of the major, like, points in my head that clicked was that, and might be that this is true to any new skill, is that you need to have some sort of a goal that you go towards, that so that you feel motivated to keep, like, doing those repetitions. And I think this is true to programming as well as drawing, is you just need to do enough of the basic stuff in order to move on. And in drawing, that would mean making, like, or drawing 1,000 circles, and eventually the circles would get better, and then I would move on to something a little bit more sort of harder to do. And the same in programming. And I'm not even sure that I'm that big of a believer in the, like, Jeff Atwood hard like the hard way to learn whatever language, that you just do, like, rote repetition. But there is a certain amount of, like, rote skill that you need in order to be able to improvise and build on top of that. But it's far less than I feel like people, especially adults, think it is. I think the older we grow, the more we think that some people are just born with this magical ability to program or to draw or to do public speaking. And it's probably the people who actually do it know that it's a lot of just hard work and goals and repetition.
Yeah, that's probably very true. I still want to talk one more, or ask one more question about the books. Is, like, why do you write children's books?
I think books are, so we all have sort of childhood books that stay with us for years to come until we grow up to be adults. Like, I have a lot of Astrid Lindgren stories that just showed me, like, what does family mean? What does friendship mean? What does, I don't know, like, what is our role in the society and so forth? And children's books are such, like, such an important medium, because they really shape the world of a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old. And that's why it's important that we also talk about more contemporary things than friendship or family, which are important for kids. And technology is such a huge part of our everyday lives nowadays. But the ways in which we teach technology come from a very sort of mechanical understanding of what it means to be computer literate or build with code. And the children's book was an idea that, okay, like, let's teach basic programming concepts. So things that, like, big computational thinking concepts, like, how do you decompose a problem into smaller pieces? What is an algorithm? What is the concept of a loop? What if we tried to teach them to kids under the age of six, even before they can read or write themselves? What if they understood the concept on a basic level, but then went on to grow up to be adults who then recognize it again when they finally in high school learn about Java or Python or Ruby or whatnot?
So actually, what is the big thing that you're trying to achieve with the books? What is the change you want to create in the world through the books?
That's a good question. I suppose the biggest change I want to see in the world is that we would have a more diverse pool of people who get excited about computers and who see the value of how computers can make our societies better. And to some extent, every industry is going to be a computer industry. Every problem is going to be a computer science problem, whether we think about biology or we think about, society or arts or sciences, and it means that computers and people will need to work together, and that's why we need more people who know how to speak to a computer. And programming is one tool in that big tool set of things, in the same way as a biologist uses a pipette or a physicist uses a prism. Programming is a tool for a computer scientist, but it's starting to be a tool for everyone, so kind of broadening that group of people.
Yeah. And I guess you get this question a lot, but I'm just going to go with it anyway. Does everyone need to learn to program?
No. I don't think I'll never write search algorithms for Google. I'll never be that caliber of a programmer. Yeah. But I think we need people who understand computers. Mm. We need different role models within computing. We need nurses who understand how computers can help them do their work better. We need biologists who can use code confidently. I think coding and programming is one problem-solving tool to the world, just as Legos pens or so forth are in the future. And so, that's why it's important to teach it to kids, because it's equally important to teach them how distinct different birch types from one another or so forth. It's to teach them the basics of computers.
And so why are you discriminating against us adults?
I feel like, yeah, that's a good question. A lot of time people ask, like, can I attend Rails girls if I'm a guy? I feel like there's more potential in kids, at least from my perspective. Kids are actually a really nice group of users to work with. They are so open-minded and they don't have the prejudices that adults do have already. But I've seen, when I was working in New York, I worked at a company who did a lot of sort of career shifting or leveling up, skills leveling up type of code education. And it was really empowering to see 60-year-old people change their careers from like lower paying QA jobs into actual programming jobs, or just switch careers in their 40s or 50s. And I think it's a tool for everyone to consider, at least.
Yeah. And why would a 60-year-old not learn from Ruby, Hello Ruby book?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So writing the book, I mean, you've had to kind of go into learning a lot. I mean, to thinking about learning and how do people learn. Can you talk a little about that? So what have you learned about learning?
Learned about learning. Well, what I've learned is the way we approach programming is, at least, or learning technology and new things is very mechanical. Mm-hmm. And very one-dimensional. And to some extent, I feel like our industry, especially the people who work within technology, we come from a very sort of solution-centric mindset that, let's build an app that teaches people programming, or let's make an app that solves problem X and Y and Z. And that's amazing. And that's one of the great things about the sort of technology communities, that we are so sort of solution-centric. But the more I've worked with this problem, and it's been now for 4 or 5 years, the more I feel like the inspiration comes from the 70s and the 40s. And it's about the principles and values and frameworks we use when we assess different possibilities. And one example of this is we're working now on the application side of things, and I'm sort of trying to imagine what kind of an app would suit the Hello Ruby world. And it's a spoiler, it's not going to be a learn to code app. Yeah. And I think the biggest inspiration for us comes from the Maria Montessori pedagogy, on the pedagogy that Maria Montessori built, which is, well, nowadays known as the Montessori pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And her idea is that, like, the Montessori materials should be simple, they should be self-teaching, they should be sequential, they should be beautiful. And sort of trying to abstract from that, okay, these principles worked in the early 19th or early 20th century. How should we design mobile apps based on these ideas, and sort of having a more of a dialogue with the pedagogy world and the teachers who actually know how kids think and grow up, instead of trying to solve problems in a vacuum.
Okay, and based on the things that you've learned from Montessori or other sources that you mentioned, how will that change the book you're writing? How will that show in the book?
I've been a little bit I've been again a little bit like solution centric in the book. So I think I'm going to leave more room for discussions, mm-hmm. Just like what kind of discussions can a father and a kid, or a mother or a kid, or a teacher or a kid have with one another. I'm going to put more focus on tangible, like physical learning, like how can kids who like can't sit still on their chairs and focus on crafting or solving little logic puzzles, how can they still learn about this thing? So sort of catering towards different learning skills and disciplines, learning abilities.
But I think that's really, really interesting, because that's kind of like I've also tried teaching coding to a couple of kids, and I think one of the like the big things is that like the attention span is so short, and the fact that a lot of it happens while sitting at a computer. Yeah. And I think that's hard.
So one time we were like doing, I think it was code.org or some of these like exercises with little kids, and we would run into a problem, and then we would start to have a discussion about problem solving tactics, like, okay, how do you in general work when you run into a problem like this, or even more abstractly, like any type of problem, and the discussion just ended up being so fascinating that we ended up pulling all of the kids from their computers and sitting down on the floor and having like a big discussion about the worries of 6 years old in the world in general. And the worries of 6 year olds are amazing. One of the kids was worried that his paper computer would tear, and then one of the kids was worried that his dog would lose all of his fur, and then the third kid was worried about the war breaking up, or so very diverse, like weird worries. Yeah. And then we would put all of the worries on the wall, mm-hmm. the worry wall, and then we would solve them and like try to figure out, like, okay, what can we do so that your dog doesn't lose all of its fur and so forth? So it's sort of having the open-mindedness to approach these situations and try to abstract what are the things that the kids are actually learning, not only focusing that do they actually complete this exercise and get the like 5 out of 5 stars of JavaScript basics on the computer, more, yeah, having that open mind and showing context.
And I think that's a big shift that's kind of happening in education and the role of the teacher in the world, that it's, I mean, teachers used to be the center of the center of attention, and they were kind of the like leading the whole teaching situation. Whereas now I think it's kind of moving towards just the kids being in the main role, and the teachers just facilitating the learning, and kind of more of a like a coaching approach.
Yeah. And programming is a perfect like subject to learn about those things, because so many teachers are so afraid that, oh, I don't know enough about programming and like to teach it to kids. And I'm like, you don't know about like, I don't know, global warming, but you still teach at like a PhD level, yeah. But you still teach that to kids, and it's okay. And chances are that like during the first class in your programming class, there's going to be one kid who's just way better than you'll ever be. But then it's you as a like a professional, you can give context to the things that the kids are learning. You can encourage them to ask questions from another, that one brilliant kid can help the other kids, and so forth and so forth. So it's kind of, yeah, I definitely agree that the role of the teacher is changing a lot.
Yeah. And I started writing code when I was a kid, and when I was in school, I was already like doing a lot of programming. And when they were starting, actually we had a school that taught programming. Yeah. And what was actually really awesome was that the teacher kind of very quickly noticed that me and a friend of mine, we were actually, that we already knew how to program. Mm-hmm. And basically what he did was he just said that, like, you can do whatever as long as it's programming. Mm-hmm. And we just spent the whole lifetime just learning. We did focus on learning programming, but the fact was that, like, he didn't force us to go through the very basics mm-hmm. that the rest of the, like, the class was going through. Because he just noticed immediately that we can learn more when we just do it by ourselves. And I think that was if he broke some rules by doing that. Yeah, he probably did back then. But I mean, that was a really good call from him.
Yeah.
I mean, really, really good.
Yeah. And it's really amazing when you think about all of the choices people have nowadays of learning new things. Like, you can study quantum computing in MIT for free through like a webcast or like a MOOC. And you can study so many different things. And it's more about like sparking the curiosity of the kid and showing them the direction that, hey, go here and like, That's what I tell all the undergrads nowadays, that like, savor the time you have in school, because like, life is just going to get busier for you. And of course, we still like try to include learning to our everyday lives. But still, it's just such a magical and wonderful time now to be in that age group where you still have time to full time learn.
Yeah, but then again, when I one of the gripes that I have with education or like university or so on is that it always seems to go like that. You first walk through the theory mm-hmm. and then you go into the practice. And I've always felt that it's easier to go the other way around, that it's kind of easier to first find the problem where you actually need the theory and then pull the theory that you need.
Yeah, totally.
And that's why I didn't really like university that much, because it was so much easier for me to do it the other way around.
Yeah. No, agreed. And I think a lot of the ways in which we teach technology is, again, very mechanical and theoretical. And one of the goals for the summer school is to teach people for phenomenon-based learning about these different things. So say you teach kids about recycling and what is recycling as a concept. And sure that you do that already in schools, but what you sort of forget, or you take it only to the point where you teach kids that thing A goes to the A bucket and thing B goes to the B bucket. But then you like forget to discuss this whole thing that what if computers were there to help us recycle things, and like what will a world where there's Zen robotics and there's Enevo, which physically makes a computer or like a garbage bin into a computer, how will a human's role in recycling change at that point? And then you can also use that opportunity to teach kids about sorting algorithms and different ways of like sorting data and what kind of like things do you need in order to sort stuff, and maybe you can do that through physical play and so forth, instead of just sort of having like a big discussion for kids about these are the different sorting algorithms. There is merge sort and there's bubble sort and there's la la la. So yeah.
Yeah, and I like the fact that you kind of, the thing that you already started talking about is like recycling, which is like a big thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, solving that would be a huge thing versus, I mean, just creating yet another app. Mm-hmm. I mean, that you're kind of applying the skills to different...
Back to the question of why kids, I feel like the kids are to some extent like an open book at this point, or tabula rasa, and you can, if you influence them in the right manner, you can come up with totally different kinds of solutions.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's, and I mean, that's huge. If that's something that you can facilitate or help happen, I mean, that's huge.
Yeah.
Amazing. Thanks a lot for your time. It's really, really fun having a chat with you.
Thank you.
Okay, so thanks for listening. Shares on social media and reviews on iTunes are very welcome and highly appreciated. Also, the podcast is looking for sponsors, so if your company would be interested in supporting the podcast, send me an email at sami@boslevelpodcast.com. Tune in again in 2 weeks. Okay, bye.